Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the University of Chicago's 24th annual Martin Luther King Jr. commemoration celebration. I am honored to stand before you in this beautiful chapel where 58 years ago, Dr. King delivered his first major address in the city of Chicago. His decision to speak at Rockefeller was a demonstration of his affinity for students and belief in the power of young leaders. It was also an acknowledgement that institutions like the University of Chicago have a responsibility to support young leaders' efforts to have positive impacts on our communities. And that is the leadership legacy he leaves. How can we change our communities for the better? In his own words, Dr. King said, "Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others?" As for students, we are uniquely positioned to answer that question. Not only do we have the opportunity to dedicate time and energy to rigorous academic pursuits, but we also have the responsibility to work diligently to influence social changes that benefit generations beyond our own. At the University of Chicago, I have experienced the dedicated commitment of my fellow students to be forces for good, and have benefited from the support of a university that truly values the contributions we as students make to our communities, and that provides us with the resources and opportunities to do it. In fact, our university president, Robert Zimmer, has highlighted the importance of diversity and social engagement, and has said that we have an obligation to see that the greatest variety of perspectives is brought to bear on the issues before us as scholars and citizens. As students, I challenge you to take advantage of the unique position we are in. Be student leaders, be forces for good. Build upon the foundation of support our university provides, and begin today as we gather to celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. King by taking time to reflect on the progress of civil rights and the work we have left to do in creating equal opportunities for all people. Thank you all, and it is now my privilege to introduce the University of Chicago's 13th president, Robert J. Zimmer.
Thank you very much, Alexandra, and thanks to all of you for joining us here this evening. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the University of Chicago's annual celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Every year, this occasion gives us an opportunity to celebrate Dr. King as an individual of historical significance and great personal, remarkable courage. But it also gives us an opportunity to look back and think about the historical context of his work and to look forward to tell us what it is that we should be thinking about doing. I often think about time periods, and it's only 151 years ago since Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. That was a moment that was one key step in our nation's effort to redress what was surely the most destructive and repellent part of our collective past. And in the context of all of our individual lives, 151 years ago seems like a very long time, but in reality, it's just two lifetimes. It's a very short period for a community to fully emerge from what was an extremely difficult situation. So one feature that we should be recognizing and celebrating today is just how great the achievements of the African American community are in this period of just two lifetimes, and how much these achievements have been of benefit to all of us in the nation. Dr. King was, of course, a key figure in helping the nation move forward with providing the appropriate legal, social, educational, economic, and political context for creating opportunity for the African American community in particular, but of course for others as well. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which in particular prohibits segregation in the United States on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. The legislation was a major event for the nation and made real for so many the context of opportunity and participation that Dr. King stood for. The Civil Rights Act is one of the many visible and tangible outcomes of Dr. King's work. When Dr. King spoke at the University of Chicago in 1956 on one of the three visits he made to our campus, He told the audience that in the fight for social justice, the most important thing to remember is that you must keep moving. And this exhortation to keep moving is asking us not only to look back, but to look forward about the ongoing work that needs to be done and the opportunities that lie before us. The University of Chicago is a complex institution, many activities, many programs, affiliated communities around the world. But one of the key attributes on which we have been focused is the importance of diverse perspectives and backgrounds to our very fundamental missions of research, education, and impact. This has led us to emphasize inclusion at every level of activities, ensuring that our faculty, our students, our staff, our board of trustees, those firms that we contract with, professionals that we employ, those in our charter schools, those with whom we engage abroad, the nature of our arts communities, our relationships in the city of Chicago, and the way we design various programs to support all this work and more, that they all have a built-in understanding of the importance of diversity, inclusion, and broad-based engagement. It is an ongoing effort about which we can never be complacent, in which we endeavor to follow Dr. King's exhortation to keep moving. We know we have a great deal more to do, and we are committed to doing it. Earlier this afternoon, I had the privilege of conferring this year's Diversity Leadership Awards. These are awards that recognize university alumni and staff members whose work embodies Dr. King's values and his commitment to equality and freedom for all. And I just want to highlight and recognize this year's winners. The 2014 Diversity Leadership Alumni Award is Dr. Aida Giancello, an advocate and activist for the health of women and ethnic minorities and a professor of medicine at Northwestern University. She received both her master's and doctoral degrees from the School of Social Services Administration at the University of Chicago. She's a founder of many local and national health and human service organizations and has a long career in medicine. We were fortunate to honor two staff members this year for the Diversity Leadership Staff Awards, Kathy Ford and Theaster Gates. Kathy Ford, Assistant Dean of Students and Advisor in the College, has championed many significant projects supporting LGBTQ equality in our university community, notably our domestic partnership benefits policy and our nation-leading mentoring program for LGBTQ students. Theaster Gates, Director of the University's Arts and Public Life Initiative and a faculty member in the Department of Visual Arts, is a Chicago-based installation artist who's been internationally recognized for his work in fostering critical engagement between diverse audiences from the local to the international level, and to an original approach to the arts and community development. He's a leader of the university's new Washington Parts Incubator. And I just asked that Theaster, Kathy, and Aida, if they would just stand and be recognized. Now, I'd also like to take a moment to personally welcome our special guest this evening, Governor Devon Patrick of Massachusetts, who will be introduced more fully in just a moment. Governor Patrick worked as a civil rights lawyer and was appointed United States Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights under President Clinton. In 2006, he was elected the 71st governor of Massachusetts. And by way of conclusion, let me just turn again to Dr. King. And Alexandra mentioned this comment that Dr. King made when he said that an individual has not started living fully until they can rise to the broader concerns of humanity. Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? If we as individuals follow Dr. King's commitment to contributing to the many communities of which we are part, and if we follow the example of the dedicated individuals here with us today, some of whom I've recognized and some of whom I've not, we will move forward to the brighter future that Dr. King envisioned. and which through his own passion he made palpable and tangible for us all. Once again, welcome.
When I was on my way out, when we were on our way out here, Governor Patrick advised me that shorter was better. And that's difficult for me, even under the best of circumstances. But it's hard when I'm introducing someone for whom I have such deep admiration. A valued member of the Board of Advisors of the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics, and one of Chicago's most distinguished favorite sons. Deval Patrick grew up just a few miles from here, in the shadows of the Robert Taylor Holmes housing project. His father left the family when he was four, and Deval and his sister and his mother moved into a tenement apartment with his grandparents. The three of them shared a bedroom with one bunk bed, and they rotated each night one of them would take a turn sleeping on the floor that was softened only by a makeshift mattress of newspapers. And Duval ran a familiar gauntlet of gangs and violence to get to and from overcrowded and underfunded schools. But when he was in eighth grade, a Chicago public school teacher recognized a light, a spark, and nominated Duval for a scholarship from the Better Chance Foundation to attend the Milton Academy in Massachusetts. Now, the staggering distance between Chicago's most desperate neighborhood and one of America's elite prep schools can't be measured in mere miles. When Duval arrived for his first day of class, he wore a windbreaker because he was told that for the gentlemen of Milton, jackets were required. Yet, given the chance, Duval overcame all the challenges, sartorial and academic, and excelled at Milton. He went on to Harvard College and the Harvard Law School, institutions of such quality, President Zimmer, that they are said to rival our own. These achievements alone would have marked Duval as the personification of Dr. King's dream. But what Duval did after, with all that knowledge and all that ability, honored Dr. King's spirit. Having sprung forward, Duval reached back. As an attorney for the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, as chief of the Civil Rights Division in the United States Department of Justice, and later as general counsel to two of America's largest corporations, where he broke down historic barriers. I first met Duval in 2006. My sister Joan, who lives in Arlington, Massachusetts, had gained some notoriety as a volunteer organizer in local elections. And one day, she called me with great excitement, and she said, David, I never do this, but I just met a guy who's running for governor of Massachusetts, and you have to work for him. And when I finally had a chance to meet Duval, I understood exactly why she felt that way. Having lived an improbable life, he was an unapologetic idealist in a cynical age, brimming with ideas about how to move his state forward and expand opportunity to every community and every citizen. And while the jaded political establishment on Beacon Hill dismissed him as hopelessly naive, Duval took his case directly to the people. A mere asterisk in the polls when he began, Duval went town by town, sometimes door by door, building a movement for change and reform, the likes of which the Commonwealth hadn't seen since a bunch of rabble-rousers dumped tea in the Boston Harbor. It's time to put your cynicism down, he told the people of Massachusetts. Put it down, stand with me, and take that leap of faith, because I'm not asking you to take a chance on me. I'm asking you to take a chance on your own aspirations. Take a chance on hope. Take a chance on hope. What a wonderful exhortation. And the people of Massachusetts responded. This political outsider, a black man running to become governor of a state whose residents are overwhelmingly white, won landslide victories in the primary and general elections, and now, completing his second term, he has written an unrivaled record of accomplishment that reflects a thoughtful and visionary strategy for the state's future. Under Governor Patrick's leadership, Massachusetts has become the national leader in energy efficiency. He's built on the Commonwealth's institutional advantages to make it a center for biotechnology. He doubled the state's investment in infrastructure and shepherded its pioneering health reform in such a way as to ensure fully 98% of the Commonwealth's citizens have coverage today, and he did it while adding only 1% more to the budget each year. But it's only fitting that a man whose life was transformed by education would be a champion for quality education for all of his citizens. Massachusetts' schools were highly rated when Governor Patrick took office. Today they're even better. But he's made it his special focus to close the achievement gap between rich and poor school districts. He's worked to reform the community colleges that are the gateway to a better future for many, and to provide additional financial assistance for students in need. At the height of the recession, when other states were cutting back on education, Governor Patrick passed $1 billion in tax increases to ensure that the children of Massachusetts wouldn't fall behind. Second and third graders didn't have the luxury of sitting things out until the recession passed, he explained. Decades ago, a Chicago school teacher saw the potential in Deval Patrick, and with a chance she made possible, he has become a force for civility and justice and progress. I can think of no better person to help us reflect on the legacy of Dr. King than a man who honors it every day through his own shining example. Please help me welcome the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick.
Thank you. Thank you. David, what an incredible introduction. It's I feel like you've already said anything I would have said. You certainly told all the stories I was going to tell. I want to thank you for that and for your friendship and for the extraordinary help and coaching and leadership that you have given to this political amateur. I want to acknowledge and thank President Zimmer and all of the leadership here at the University of Chicago for being here and for the generous invitation to join you tonight. I want to acknowledge the elected officials who are here and all of the distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, family, nice to see you. It's really been such a warm welcome, and I thank you. And it's a wonderful contrast to the weather tonight. But that's Chicago, right? The Hawk is here. Thank you all for having me. I am really honored to be here at the University of Chicago this evening to commemorate the life and the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Thanks to him, many of us work and play and study and live in settings that would have been unthinkable, even in some circumstances illegal, for our parents and grandparents. And as I'm convinced that it is impossible to reduce Dr. King's impact to a speech of reasonable length, I'm looking forward to keeping my remarks short and spending most of our time together with your questions and comments. David said, and many of you know, I grew up not far from here on 54th and Wabash in the 50s and the 60s. I heard Dr. King speak once in those years. He was addressing a crowd in a park somewhere on the south side of Chicago, and my mother took my sister and me to hear him. I think I was about 6 or 7 years old at the time, and candidly, I don't remember a single word he said. But I do remember what it felt like. I remember the deep solemnity of the occasion. I remember how at that moment I felt connected to all those other people in that park, people like me of limited means but limitless hope. And I remember feeling the power of that hope, how it gave shape and purpose to the lives we were all trying to lead, still does. As I have come over the years to read his writings and listen to his speeches, and oh, these are speeches to be listened to, I am struck by how often he spoke of service. Like Christ himself, Dr. King understood servant leadership. His was a model of selfless leadership, of humility, of outwardness. The beloved community Dr. King envisioned and helped lead us to was a place where people took responsibility for each other, where we turned to each other rather than on each other. As he put it, and as several speakers have acknowledged already tonight, life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? My community in those days in the 50s and 60s was like that. As David said, I lived there with my grandparents and various other relatives who came and went, my mother and sister in a two-bedroom tenement. My mother, sister, and I shared one of those bedrooms and that set of bunk beds David talked about, so we would rotate top bunk, bottom bunk, floor every third night on the floor. In those days, over on Wabash Avenue, everything was broken. Broken sidewalks and playgrounds, broken families. There was a whole lot we didn't have. But one thing we did have was a very strong sense of community. Because those were days when every child was under the jurisdiction of every single adult on the block. If you messed up down the street in front of Ms. Jones, she'd go upside your head as if you were hers and then call home. So you got it two times. I have to digress here and tell you about a wonderful experience I had last year when the street along my old block was renamed after me. I was dreading the ceremony, candidly, because it's a little embarrassing and because it's usually the kind of thing that happens to people who are dead. But it was a lovely occasion, made more so by the unexpected presence of kids from a school in the next block who were permitted to come out and watch the scene and say hello. I know from experience what can happen when you give a kid a chance to imagine a positive path like mine. In any event, after the news street signs were unveiled, we took a walk down the block to take pictures in front of the place where I lived, in fact, where I was born. Some of the staff who were with me had heard me describe this place and this neighborhood in countless speeches in terms very like those I've used tonight. They had heard me describe Ms. Jones and just assumed she was a metaphor for caring adults on the block. So I was delighted when Ms. Carrie Jones came toddling up to see what all the fuss was about. Of course, she is only now the age I thought she was when I was a kid on the South Side. She was just as curious as she always had been, and just as caring, which brings me back to Dr. King's emphasis on service. See, his emphasis was not on the service of those elected or appointed to high office. It was not about the service of volunteers alone. All of that is important. Dr. King was about service not as what you do, but as who you are. He said everybody can serve. You don't have to have a PhD to serve. You don't have to be able to make your subject and your verb agree to serve. You only need a heart full of grace, a soul motivated by love. And this, for me, is the nub of it. Dr. King brought love into public discourse. Imagine that. When's the last time you heard a public figure talk about love as a motivation for policy choices? Even politically active faith leaders seem silent on the notion. And don't even get me started on the disconnect between Christ's love and the religious rights positions on things like marriage equality or healthcare security. Love is not a substitute for wise policy or effective programs. It's not a substitute for personal responsibility or moral rectitude or perseverance. Love is not an excuse. But without love, it's hard to make sense of compassion itself, or common destiny, or community. We could use more of Dr. King's message right now. In a society dedicated to equality, income equality is getting worse. As we emerge from the global recession, for those already college educated and with transferable skills, the knowledge-based job market is wide open. Those already with money to invest benefit from the resurgence of the Dow. But the ability of people to bridge that gap is harder than ever. The poor are no longer just the abject destitute. Nearly half of food stamp recipients in Massachusetts are working people. Our homeless population living in motels recently hit an all-time high, many of them school-aged children. All this in a state where our children lead the nation in achievement, income levels are well above average, unemployment is down, and the innovation economy is on fire. Across the entire country, many middle-class families where both parents work still can't get ahead, let alone imagine a better life for their children. According to Opportunity Nation, for the first time in America, today's young adults risk having lower educational attainment rates on average than their parents. Only 6% of children born to parents at the bottom, children like me, make it to the top. Children in many European countries now have greater socioeconomic mobility than those in the United States. Imagine that. The American dream is in trouble. Why should any of that matter? Because opportunity is central to who we are as a nation. And I ask you to consider this. We are the only nation in human history not organized the way nations are normally organized. We're not organized around a common religion or language or even a common culture. We weren't organized because of the natural forces of geography. We're the only nation organized around a handful of civic ideals. And we've defined those ideals over time and through struggle as equality, freedom, and fair play. That's what America has been about for more people for a longer time than any other nation ever. Well, opportunity is what makes all our civic ideals possible. Without opportunity, our civic ideals are nothing but rhetorical flourishes. But opportunity is not inevitable. It doesn't just happen. Each generation of Americans has had to strive and to sacrifice to make opportunity real. Whether it was freeing the slaves or giving women the vote in one era, the GI Bill, rural electrification, or the interstate highway system in another, the struggle for civil rights in Dr. King's time and our own, or expanding broadband and early education and closing the achievement gap today, making opportunity real requires action. You can reason your way to practical solutions with many others on these and other issues, but without love, you cannot fully appreciate why addressing them is a matter of real urgency. My job, my mission in my current role is to help somebody every day in every way I can. I have governed with the belief that government can be a powerful tool in helping people help themselves. But for a society to prosper, we need so much more than what government can do. We need more than just what governors and mayors and presidents can do alone. Dr. King taught us that service is power, transformative power. We need hearts full of grace and souls generated by love. One thing I have tried to do is to elevate this value, to draw attention to the power of service. At my second inauguration in 2011, we gathered together eighth graders from every one of the 351 cities and towns in the Commonwealth who were themselves service leaders. I figured the athletes and scholars and artists have channels to flourish and be recognized for, but not always the servant leaders. We called it Project 351. They came to Boston to talk about the power of service, to go out and then do a project together and then be sent back, charged to spread the word about the value of service. Since that first Saturday, Project 351 has been reimagined as a youth service initiative dedicated to building unity and leadership. Every year since, on MLK weekend, an eighth grade ambassador from every city and town in Massachusetts comes to our state house for a day and a message of service. The network of ambassadors has grown and remained active. We have reunions and service days, all to the effect of encouraging these magnificent young people to be the servant leaders of tomorrow. Every time I attend a Project 351 event, I am reinvigorated about what the future holds for Massachusetts, indeed for the whole country. I usually get them to talk about the spirit of service, what motivates them. I've come right out and claim, I haven't come right out and claim the spirit of love yet, because I don't want to get them. They're eighth graders, all kind of squishy and squirmy. But this coming Saturday, when the next class of ambassadors convenes, I just might, because I'm convinced that that, more than anything, will lead us to the beloved community Dr. King envisioned. Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
So, after those inspiring and provocative remarks, we invite questions from the audience. There's a microphone down the center aisle. And please step up. And I think we can take four or five questions, I'm told. So I don't want those at the end of the line to be disappointed. Yes, sir.
Yes. Good evening, Governor.
Good evening.
Do I need this?
I do need this.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Last fall, I was in Boston at Harvard, and I'm back here in Chicago working as a school administrator.
All right.
So I have a question to you about school and education. You mentioned love. And in our country right now, it appears that there is a strong neoliberal current to create more zero-tolerance charter schools that do not tolerate or seem to operate with that spirit of grace concerning African-American men. It also seems to contribute to the school-to-prison pipeline and the new Jim Crow that Michelle Alexander speaks to.
You say contribute to the school-to-prison pipeline?
Yes.
The zero-tolerance charter schools?
The zero-tolerance policies.
Policies, per se. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, within schools.
Okay.
I was wondering what your educational policy is concerning suspension rates, expulsion rates among black and brown youth, particularly in Boston, but also it seems like you have an ear with the president and Arne Duncan.
So what's your first name?
Robert.
Robert, I'm so sorry our time is up. Do you mind? There's a risk in conversation in a place like this because you probably have already written a book on this subject, right? This was your PhD, am I right?
No, not yet.
No? So you asked me what the policy is in Boston. The state doesn't drive the policies in Boston. We drive policies statewide, and the policies on discipline, frankly, vary from community to community. My own view is that we have to have education that reaches kids where they are. And not every kid learns the same way. And that has implications, it seems to me, for everything from the length of the school day or year, right? Because we still have a calendar and a schedule that's based on farming. I don't mean just us. I mean, that's the norm nationally. To how we imagine what a classroom is. A lot of kids, we were talking about this at a Q&A earlier with some students, a lot of kids learn by doing. They learn by touch and not by sitting in a classroom in the traditional. Do you want me to stand up straight if you're going to photograph me like that? Okay. So, I think there are going to be some kids whose, and you will know this, and as a parent I know this, whose disciplinary actions don't have to do with them being bad kids, but have to do with them being hungry, distracted, scared, what have you. I, for one, do not believe that educational success depends on one strategy, a one-size-fits-all. And so I don't have one answer. My view, I do believe, I will say this categorically, and I know there's some research on the other side of this, small classes matter, especially for younger kids. Look, I'm not a policy, I'm saying this as a parent and as a student. Kids are hungry for the attention of adults. They're hungry for the attention. They may not want that attention to come from mom and dad, but they want somebody to pay attention to them. And to care about them and to love them. And that's hard to do in a class with 30 or 40 kids. I've been in those classes as a student. It's easier to do in a class of a dozen kids. I've been in those classes as a student. So that's my two cents.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
How's it going, Governor Patrick? I'm Tom Snyder. Tom? I just graduated this year from your undergrad institution, and now I'm here doing a JD PhD, PhD in history. And sort of looking back on the past 50 years, it's the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, President Johnson's speech at the University of Michigan. And I've been reading a lot of articles in the Washington Post, and they've been very, I guess, difficult for me to read because there's not a discourse in Washington right now about renewing the war on poverty, renewing this idea of rebuilding urban centers, rebuilding urban communities, expanding social programs. What do the Democrats have to do in the next election to shift that talk towards urban renewal, towards programs that help the least among us? Not in the least sense being that these people don't matter, but they matter the most to building a strong community. And how can the Democrats really seize upon that idea and bring back this sense that we have to help those who have the most need in our society?
Tom, that's a huge question. There are two things Democrats need to do, in my view. And remember, I am an amateur. I've only run for one office two times. The first thing Democrats have to do, I believe, is free ourselves from some of the constraints of conventional political orthodoxy. Our language, I mean, we are fabulous at talking about what's wrong with the other side. We don't have as much to say about what's right with us. That's the first thing. Second thing, and I've made this point before, is grow a backbone. We get very nervous when a good idea is challenged, or a good idea that might be time to be updated is criticized or something like that. We get very nervous about that. We don't go to the values question. And to me, I mean, let me just put my bona fides out there, come clean with you. I'm a capitalist. Now, I'm not a market fundamentalist. I don't think the market gets everything just right all the time. I don't think government should solve every problem in everybody's life, but I do think government has a role in helping people help themselves. And I think Democrats would go a long way, and frankly, leaders would go a long way in calling out how the war on poverty turned into a war on poor people and elevating this idea of the American dream. Because this is what I was trying to get at in my remarks. If you walk away from a story like mine, a personal story like mine, if you say that's yesterday, we're done. We are done, because that is what this country is about. It's not just a tag on to other stuff. That is what we are about. And if that is what we are about, we have to do the things on both the public and the private side that are enabling of people. And it may range from how we invest again in our basic infrastructure. And by that, I don't just mean roads, rails, and bridges. I mean broadband. I mean healthcare. I mean all the stuff. I mean good schools, all the things the public builds as a platform for personal ambition and private investment, for that matter. And stop being nervous about that. Stop being uncomfortable about that. And by the way, all the evidence on the other side that the way you grow is just by, you know, cutting taxes, crushing unions, and waiting, the evidence is on our side of that argument, overwhelming. So you ask me what Democrats need to do. I think Democrats need to go to values, grow a backbone, and then on the political side, run at the grassroots. Because frankly, regular old citizens, all those poor folks who've been in straits for a long time, but the middle class who are a paycheck away from being poor, they get it. They get this. And they are, I think, would respond to something other than what is offered by the hard right, which is just being mad.
Thank you.
But you got to ask David. He would know better than me.
Governor, we're going to get these final questions, and I just want to ask one follow-up to this, because since we're commemorating Dr. King, we ought to acknowledge how things have changed in our economy since Dr. King. And we've seen this rapid increase in technology, the rapid advance of technology, globalization, that have made many jobs that were good middle class jobs and good opportunities for unskilled workers to make a good living obsolete. And I know that a lot of what you've done in Massachusetts is with that in mind. What is the strategy for pushing back on these economic forces that are a byproduct of the system, the capitalist system that you embrace, that most people do?
So I was at, you remember the city of Pittsfield?
Mm-hmm.
Pittsfield is a medium-sized, small city in western Massachusetts where GE had a presence for a long time. And it was kind of a company town. GE wouldn't describe that, but describe it that way. But they were the biggest game in town for a long time. And in the 1970s, I think it was, maybe early 80s, GE pulled out and pulled out fast. And it was shattering to the town. And I remember going to to an event with the mayor, one mayor removed, who was a wonderful leader, I thought. And it was kind of a community meeting, and he was speaking to this point. What's the future of Pittsfield, and how are we going to get going? And the mayor at that point was in the midst of trying to establish Pittsfield as a center for the cultural and creative arts in a county that had a lot of this activity, but as an economic driver. And he made a comment to one of the, if I may describe in this way, old-timers, who was saying, you know, the economy's changed and GE left and all that. He said, I'm paraphrasing, the sooner we stop mourning the loss of GE and start facing the future, the better off we will be. And so in Massachusetts, we have stopped fretting about the kinds of, you know, when Dr. King was alive, people worked in manufacturing jobs for their whole lives and retired with pensions, and it was a good thing. But because that has gone from much, not all, of Massachusetts, doesn't mean we have to, that our solution lies in trying to figure out how to go back. Our solution lies, I believe, in preparing people for the kinds of jobs we have. And they're not all PhD jobs. They're going to be a level of skills, though, that require more than a high school degree, but not necessarily a college degree. That's what the community college reform that you mentioned was about. How do we get the community colleges to serve as a workforce training platform and be connected to the economy in the regions where they operate? I will tell you that the early returns, just as one data point, advanced manufacturing, right? Pipe fitters today need to know how to read plan, right? It's different. They need to know how to read. We've had a 50% increase in advanced manufacturing growth, job growth, in the last 3 years in Massachusetts over what it was in the previous two administrations before ours. And remember, in the last 3 years, it wasn't so good economically. So there's a way forward. That's not the only way. There's a way forward. But I think it is about embracing those new realities. And I'll say just this one last thing. On the national policy level, we all talk about the globalization of the economy, and there is a lot of truth in that. But what, in my observation, is globalized is capital, not labor. In order for labor to be globalized truly, in order for labor to move as freely as capital does, for our broad economic benefit, we have got to have modernization of our immigration laws. It's holding us back, and it's also wrong in its current form. You good? Right. Hi.
Hi.
Right.
For one, if anyone thinks I'm a girl, I'm not.
What's your name?
But my question was, what was your childhood like?
What's your name?
Rioma.
Rioma?
If you can't pronounce that, my name is James.
Okay. What was my child? How old are you, James?
Nine.
Nine. What was my childhood like? I'm trying to think what I was doing when I was nine. What grade are you in?
Fourth.
So I was at school at the Terrell School, which is, the building's still there, but the name is gone. It's on 54th and State. All the Robert Taylor homes were up and active, and the school was built for the population in the projects and the neighborhood, neighbors close by. We were probably 30 kids in a classroom. We had these great, strong, dedicated teachers. They were the, frankly, the only people with college education I was around. They loved us. You say you're in fourth grade. My third grade teacher, Mrs. Threet, came to my inauguration. She had such an impact on me, and I stayed in touch with her. My sixth grade teacher in that same school taught us to count and say the greetings in German, took us to the first opera I'd ever been to. I didn't know what they were singing about. I still don't know, but I love it. There was a new movie out at the time called The Sound of Music, and she took us to it to use it as a teaching platform for the rise of the Nazis and modern European history. You know, she was the first person who helped me imagine what it might be like to be a citizen of the world, which for a kid of 9 or 10 or 12 in those days in the 50s was huge, and I think it's still huge. So there were those good things. You know, we also had troubles. We had, you know, we had violence and drugs and gang activity. You know, it was different then, but there was gang activity, and I was protected from that by those teachers, a grandmother who would take no prisoners. Am I right, Renee? And the church ladies, those women in hats. Who would come in, and you know, we had to go to church every Sunday before breakfast.
That is a nun.
Yeah. What's that?
That is a nun.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Governor Patrick, for coming and for your words.
Thank you.
My question has to do with a recent development in your state. As I understand, your state Supreme Court recently removed retroactively all juvenile life without parole sentences with your blessing. And I'm wondering how you deal with civil rights as governor and how your training and work as a civil rights attorney impacts your work.
What's your first name?
Matt.
Matt?
Yeah.
So you mean in particular in that case or
in
generally?
General. Yeah.
Well, in that case, I wasn't, you know, I'm governor now, so I'm not the chief lawyer, but I was I support that outcome in the case because what the court said was not that there couldn't be life for a juvenile who had committed a violent crime, but that it couldn't be automatic, and that there had to be a point at some point, decades out, when public officials and corrections officials and rehabilitation experts and families of victims had a conversation about whether the person was ready to reenter public life. And to me, that is a wise decision. I got a very, very poignant letter from the parents of a woman who was, I think, a teacher who was killed by her student. After my public comments on that letter, and it was absolutely wrenching, and I tried to reply to them that you know, I understood their pain and their anger, and I wasn't saying that any given individual should necessarily be hastily paroled, but as a I would just say as a general matter, I think. Frankly, the warehousing of people has proven to be a failed public policy. And that, but the other thing that's happened while we've been warehousing, so this is the part you won't applaud, is that we have gutted the stuff we used to do to prepare people to come out. So if we're not going to have warehousing, we got to, and we shouldn't, for a whole host of reasons, then we're going to have to put in the kinds of programs that enable people to step down and be ready to rejoin productive life. And by the way, 97% of the people in prison come out one day anyway. And in Massachusetts, they've been coming out more dangerous than they were when they went in. So my views are consistent with that. We can have outrage. We can have, and we should have firm and swift justice. But we also have to be sensible in how we manage that and manage criminal justice, mindful that one day people will rejoin society, and we want them to be productive members when they do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Are you all right?
Hi.
Hi. My name is Marvin Johnson.
Marvin?
I wanted to ask a question. What advice you would give to Illinois in terms of privatizing? There's good privatizing and there's bad privatizing.
Privatizing.
Privatizing. The resources that's critical to running our state, a lot of those resources over the last 15 years have been privatized from the toll road, from our toll parking meters.
Those, the parking lots too, didn't you?
Yeah, parking lots too. My point is that a lot of that revenue that used to come in to pay our bills are no longer there. So now it's a situation we got to figure out where do we extract this money from to pay our bills. Citizens of Illinois has become real concerned about that because there's situations going on with our Social Security, situations going on with maybe extracting money from the pension, and other areas where those things would never have been considered to be even a discussion and talking about figuring out how to extract that money to pay our bills. So what advice would you give in terms of picking good things to privatize and bad things to privatize?
Marvin, that is a very important question, but you don't seriously think I'm going to give advice on how to run Illinois. I have a state of my own. I mean, here's some principles, all right? This is because we've been trying to think through this, some of these same issues. Mm. There isn't really a very good model of a public-private partnership, in an infrastructure partnership, let me put it that way, in the United States yet. There's some pretty good models elsewhere in the world. I've been to visit with some of them. You know, I was in Asia last month, and we had a long visit with the entity created to run the subway and commuter rails in Hong Kong. It's incredible. It's a great system, and it works very well, and they pay a dividend to Hong Kong of about $1.5 billion every year. So that's right, they thought through that, and they thought it through beyond the rail piece, but the real estate piece as well works pretty well. There's some others that that don't. One principle that I'm concerned about is the notion of basically selling or leasing a public asset, and then using those proceeds to pay operations. That's like rather than pay down debt, for example, because it seems to me like you want to have capital. You want to raise money from the sale of capital to pay capital related costs rather than take it into operation. So I don't think there's a there's some principles we're trying to think through. I want to try one before I leave, just to kind of small scale, just to get a comfort level with it and to learn from it, because I think there's some opportunities.
Yes.
But I will say just this. It's important to keep the public in public transportation. In the same way, I think it's important to keep the public in public education.
Right.
It is a perennial and an appropriate conversation in America about what it is we want government to do and not do.
Right.
But we shouldn't be afraid of those questions. There may be a whole bunch of stuff, and we've been looking at things in Massachusetts that we've been doing that maybe we shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. Maybe the private sector should do better, or maybe we should just stop doing because it doesn't work. But to a comment I made in response to an earlier question, there are some things that are fundamentally enabling of people to make a better life for themselves and their children. Right. And sometimes we do those things together. And when we do those things together, we call that government.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Final question here.
Thank you. Governor Patrick.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming to Illinois.
Thank you.
We are so grateful to have you here.
Thank you.
I'm Attorney Brunel Donald. And sir, I have been up and down this state, shaking hands with people, watching hopelessness, hurt, suffering, fear, uncertainty about everything. Our state is very ill, sir, and the problems of the people